Welcome to Fembolden, episode 8. I'm Stephanie Graff.
And I'm Kirsten Pope.
So welcome to our special Men's World episode.
Men's World.
And as our special guest, we have an actual man.
A man.
An actual, a real life
wow.
man.
Wow, what
I
a day.
I know, what a treat. So, Joe, would you like to introduce yourself?
I would. I'm Joe Mitchell. I am a man, and I'm here representing all things masculine.
And he's so good at. He even has right. a beard. You
lots,
can't see you, it.
You don't know, but lots of testosterone in this corner.
Yes. Right. He has other qualifications as well, but mostly the beard.
Right.
So to start out our episode today, which just to clarify, when we say men's world, we want to talk about some of the gender issues that affect men because we want everyone to know that we are woke.
We're socially aware that women aren't the only people in the world
who have problems.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, we can be egalitarian.
Exactly.
It's important.
Yeah. So to start out this episode, we wanted to talk about a documentary on Netflix, which I'm sure many of you have seen. It's pretty popular.
Mm-hmm. We've referenced it a few times, but never in detail.
So it's called The Masque Livin', and we recommend that everyone go see it.
Yeah.
We all watched it for homework in preparation for this podcast, but just to give a synopsis for those of you who haven't seen it, it looks especially at boys and men in the inner city, but I think it's very applicable to all men, and it talks about especially toxic masculinity, I think is what it really focuses on. You know, there are these boys from a very young age that have these social pressures not to have very intimate relationships with other boys because, you know, like, that could be gay and they're not supposed to show emotion and how those problems really create voids. So I guess just to start out, Joe, you just watched it and it was your first time.
Yeah.
Do you feel like you related to that at all?
Yeah, in a lot of ways. So I don't know if you know this, but I used to work at a psychiatric residential treatment facility.
Oh, awesome.
So it was that's code for lockdown for juvenile delinquents, basically. And it's typically one step before juvenile hall. And they had it broken down. It was teenagers, and so there was a boys program and a girls program. And I worked on both. And there were a lot of things I saw in there that reminded me of my time working with personality disorders or other things like that. I thought it was interesting because at first it kind of felt a little bit like making a bigger deal out of something that wasn't that big of a deal. But I think that the more you look at it, the more I thought about it, it seems like a lot of the manifestations of the problems that with setting up norms for how a man is supposed to act, a lot of the way that that manifests later on in life are a lot of the problems that we have in our society. So I saw more of that as time went on. Throughout the, in the documentary, really.
Oh, side note. Joe is a nurse, so that's the backstory why you were working in the psychiatric hospital.
Yeah.
So
he wasn't one of the patients, just to clarify.
No, I clocked out and left at the end of the day.
I spent some time in a psychiatric ward.
Casually.
Yes. So do you feel like in that experience, obviously there was some chemical and physical limitations there, and especially some mental limitations, but do you feel like you could see evidence of a lack of emotional support relating to some of their problems?
I think, and on both sides, to be honest, the boys and the girls, I think the whole, in most cases, the root cause was a lack of emotional support. I'd go back and read these kids' files of the way that their home life was and things like that. And it was super eye-opening as to why they were reacting the way that they were. So the way I came to make sense of it is that they switched into what I refer to as survival mode. So if you are so concerned with some of the more rudimentary aspects of life or some of the more basic aspects of life, having more immediate, loud needs met, and then that it makes it really easy to neglect some of the other things like emotional support or self-actualization or just more psychological long-term needs. If they don't have the support that they need on a long-term consistent basis, they're complete reactionary mode. And so they're just bouncing from one episode to the next. And it makes it really hard to do things like link consequences and actions, or to treat somebody with respect, or to respond positively when somebody is treating you negatively, because it's defensive and it's survival and it's who knows if I'm going to get what I need emotionally or psychologically, and so I have to grab it for myself. And that's what eventually leads to things like domestic violence, the dregs of society, really.
And I think that was the that was kind of the premise of this documentary. I mean, the mask that they're referring, I mean, on a much smaller scale, obviously, than what you were experiencing, but this mask of feeling like I can't show emotion because that's female. Like, I have to put up this front or put up this mask or facade of being strong and being, you know, the man. I have to man up in that way, and that obviously causes damage.
And they reference this, that, you know, at a young age, you can see that little boys and little girls, they have the exact same need for care and for love and support and emotion. And, you know, when you reach pubescent, prepubescent age, it seems like girls have, like, an upspike in a need for that. And this is what they cite, or what they claim, is that really it's just society starting to kind of beat down on those boys and say, no, you actually don't need that. Where from a young age, there's no chemical, there's no physiological reason for that.
It's taught.
Mm-hmm, it's taught. Mm-hmm. And another thing I think they touched on, which would be, I think would be interesting to kind of link to your experience at the psychiatric hospital, is not just this culture of, you know, it's girly to share emotions and to show feeling, but how there's a cultural taboo on really intimate boy friendships.
Yeah.
Which I think all of us have heard this. I know I probably heard this like 1,000 times a day when I was in middle school, but like I think it's especially prevalent in our very conservative society around here. When they're talking about one of their really close guy friends or something they did with a guy, they're like, oh yeah, he's great, and like I love him, but like, no homo, I'm not gay.
Yeah.
But like, I never have to say that.
Right.
I never have to say, yeah, like, oh, me and Kirsten are so close, but like, I don't love her
but
like that.
I'm not romantically involved.
Yeah, right. Well, no, of course not.
Or even the more docile term of bromance kind of has that tinge to it.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, I need to like come up with this kitschy term for just saying I'm friends with someone of the same gender.
Right. I wouldn't necessarily say there's a female equivalent term to bromance.
No, it's just friends.
Yeah, term, exactly.
But I think, I know for me, I get so much just support, and my really rich and deep female friendships play such a huge role in my life. But
especially as a young adult, when you're in that kind of transition period between families.
Oh, exactly. And so it's like, because there were so many things that like I wouldn't want to go to tell my mom about or tell my parents about, but it's like you have these really close girlfriends that you could go to and say, you know, this is happening, and they would, and they, I think also importantly, would give you the empathy and the support that you need, rather than being like, oh, just like woman up, like what's your issue, like, but that you know you can go to them and have this really good bond. Is that something you feel like you were socially allowed to have, or do you?
Me personally?
Yeah. Do you feel like in your experience, like especially as you got to like middle school and high school, that there was a time where it kind of became like weird to be super intimate with like your guy friends?
Yeah. Well, so I think my experience might be a little bit atypical, but I felt that from a younger age. I felt a strangeness with emotional intimacy with males from a young age. And I think a lot of that had to do with just my upbringing. Mm-hmm. I wasn't very close to my dad. So as I got older, over time, it was natural to me to be affectionate or emotionally vulnerable with females because I was with my mom. And I remember, actually, in high school, was probably the first time I hugged a male friend and he told me that he loved me. And it was weird, and I really liked it. I felt really accepted. And
yes.
He actually is my best friend now and married my sister.
Oh, cool.
So it's great, because I get that, I mean, it's
yeah,
always built in.
Yeah, hug him all the time.
Yeah, exactly.
Now.
And things are better with my dad now, so I
get
that kind of thing, too. But it was...
Right.
It was a noticeable experience for me.
And different from those female relationships.
Yes.
Which I think is important to note. And they did note in the documentary, kind of that father dynamic.
Yeah.
But that is very different than, like, you. It doesn't fill the void.
Right.
Mothering doesn't necessarily fill the void of fatherhood, I guess.
Yeah, because I agree. I felt like my relationship with females highlighted different aspects of my personality.
Right.
But there were other sides, qualities that are typical, that are more typical of males than they tend to be of females. Obviously, exceptions across the board.
Right,
but
and everything's a spectrum and,
sure,
you know, all those caveats.
Yeah, but my male friends, I could relate to in a different way. When I started becoming more comfortable with that and feeling like that was more normal and more okay, it definitely served a purpose. It was significant, really significant. It helped me figure out a lot of confusing things during that time of life.
I really like that. I was having a conversation kind of along the same vein with my best friend who's married. And she and I were talking about this trend that I feel like the last couple of years has been really big in people's engagement photos or their wedding photos. Like, so excited to marry my best friend. Mm. Like, I'm with my best friend. And so we were talking about that. First of all, I love, she's my best friend, but I love her and her husband's relationship. I don't really believe in soulmates, but they're like really as close as it gets. And so it kind of took me aback as we were having this conversation where she said, you know, she's not my best friend. Because I think there's such a social stigma.
Yeah, yeah.
Because that's such like a cutesy thing to say now that someone to say, my husband's not my best friend, like, oh my gosh, that's appalling. Seriously, but her rationale is she was like, no, like you are my best friend. That's your role. That's the role that you fill, which is very different than the role that he fills. Right. Obviously, like, his role, and she said this, she's like, his role is predominant in my life. Like, he is my person. He is, like, he fulfills my needs, like, physically, mentally, emotionally, spiritually. But she's like, I just worry when people throw that around. And I've seen this, yeah. That it says, when I say this is my best friend, it's like, this is the only person I need.
It is
very isolationist. And she was like, no, like, I still need, not because there's anything wrong with my marriage, as a holistic person, I still need my female friendships.
Yeah.
I still need, not because, like, again, just reiterating this, that there's anything lacking in her marriage, but she's like, there are certain things that, not better or worse, but just a different kind of fulfillment from my relationship with the women in my life. There's way less of a stigma for her to say that than for a guy to say, like, yeah, I'm married, but, like, I still need, like, my male friendships, not just for ball on the weekends,
right.
But, like, but that you still need that support from males in your life.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's interesting because most of the time, if a conversation is going to be approaching that topic, male intimacy and vulnerability among other men, it has to have an excuse, like basketball or watching sports together or, you know, eating red meat or, like, you know what I mean? Like, there needs to be some kind of
manly activity
title to hide behind. Yeah,
exactly. Like, you can't just do like I do with some of my best friends where I walk in their front door. Like, we have no planned activity, but I just, like, climb into their bed and we just, like, talk and giggle, like, giggle. And,
yeah.
But, like, no, guys can't do that because there's, like, this all-omniscient, quote-unquote, no homo that really has to cloak everything.
Yeah. I remember one of the first times that started making sense to me as something that was independent of myself. I went to the movies with my cousin, and it was almost empty theater. It was the middle of the day. And I sat in a chair, and he left one space between us and sat in the other chair.
Guys always do that.
And I thought, what's the point of that? Like, I know you're not going to hit on me if we're sitting next to each other.
Yeah, he's your cousin.
And
so many reasons.
Even if there were lots of other people around, who cares?
But guys always do that.
Yeah,
like,
absolutely.
If, I mean, a big group of girls goes and sits down, like, they'll all just, like, sit, bing, 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 like, right next to each other. But guys will just put chairs and rows and benches, like, to just have this massive wall of personal space.
Yeah, and I don't think the reason for that is that men are fundamentally, like, less, more detached than women. I personally feel like the emotional needs and capabilities of both men and women are equal, and they're somehow not being fulfilled in some way. So just to kind of explain away that premise that men don't need that, I full-heartedly believe that they do need that just as much as women do.
I agree.
I think human thing.
One thing that I think of with this topic frequently that's interesting to me is that there are some biological and physiological factors in here that are different. So one of the things that I remember learning about, now I should have researched this a little bit more beforehand because I may be a little bit rusty on the details here, but there is a bridge, a physical connection between the lobes of our brain called the corpus callosum. And that tends to be larger in females than it does in males, typically. The reason that's relevant is because the side of our brain that processes emotions and abstract feelings and vague thoughts and that kind of thing is different than the side that where our specific defined vocabulary is.
Mm-hmm. And logical.
Exactly. So if along those lines, following that train of thought, females tend to, by large, have an easier time connecting those two things because there's more physical connection there. And so men, by definition or inherently, maybe it's a little bit tougher. That process, it doesn't come quite so naturally. It's one of those cases where I think, and I think this happens a lot of times, that the social kind of structure is both a cause and an effect of human nature.
But how do you feel like that relates to something like body issues and like body image?
I think that in most cases, the reasons for our social norms and what's acceptable and what's not acceptable is rooted in ancient evolutionary kinds of things. And this happens both in social civilization and in just our own internal physical bodies. And I'll try not to get too sciencey here, but there are a lot of things.
That's why you're a nurse. That's why one of the reasons why you're here.
Thank you. There are a lot of things in our world that are kind of leftovers from a different time where they served a different purpose. And now it's kind of become cumbersome. So our stress response system works that way. Elements of our immune system works that way. And I think that a lot of social norms and what's considered socially acceptable are kind of leftovers of these things. You know, times when the man naturally being bigger and stronger was responsible for going out and doing bigger and stronger things, for example. So as far as it relates to body issues, one thing that I've thought of with that is that it somehow is more acceptable for a female to be self-conscious of her body.
Yeah.
Which is kind of a weird backwards way to think of it.
Yeah, because women have more permission to be self-conscious.
Yeah, like it's okay to think that your body is a large part of your identity, but it's not okay for a man to think that.
Interesting. Do you feel like men actually are less self-conscious, or they just have to pretend they're less self-conscious?
Well, I suspect they're probably not less self-conscious than women are. Sometimes when I think about that, though, I'm not convinced that men even recognize that that's what it is. I don't know that they, at least with the guys, teenagers that I worked with in the treatment center, they didn't even always seem cognizant of that playing into their worldview, you know? I think that it's a reactionary thing a lot of times. And a lot of these things, a lot of deficiencies in emotional or behavioral well-being for boys manifests as anger or as other really loud and vocal problems.
And they're not necessarily putting like the exact puzzle pieces in their mind saying, why is it that I feel this way?
Yeah, exactly.
Like, not thinking through it. Like maybe some way, I hate to say this, but it's maybe a little bit typically more female to say, I'm feeling this emotion. Why am I feeling this emotion?
Because in a lot of arenas, feeling emotions is more okay for a female than for a male. And so if it's not okay to feel it and it doesn't make sense to you and you don't like it, the natural reaction is to push it down and get rid of it, not to dig it up and understand it and work through it and break it down. And so a lot of times these boys were just, they couldn't even tell you why they were mad. So I would imagine, and this is just my own speculation, but I'd imagine male body issues falls in there somewhere too.
And this is granted just from my perspective, and I could be totally off. I think that some things are the same, but I think there are some different issues with men's body issues. Like it's like, I think definitely women get made fun of less if they're like too skinny than men do. Like I think it's very rare that someone's going to make fun of a girl for being particularly like scrawny.
Yeah.
Even though they probably wouldn't have that word assigned to them anyway.
And I think there's probably equal representation in the media of both men ideal body stereotypes as well as female. But I don't think that translates to the real world as much. Like on the red carpet, men aren't going to be asked, you know, who are you wearing, or aren't necessarily going to be as demonized if they're on the beach and paparazzi, you know, takes a picture and they're rocking their dad bod or whatever. But compared to a woman who, like, you know, gains 5 pounds and she's out in a bikini and all of a sudden she's let herself go. And I think there's more of a disconnect between the media and real life between men. Not to say that there aren't those stereotypes in the media. I mean, I'm sure they're very pervasive, you know, both in movies and in music and in whatever.
Here's something interesting I noticed. And I've noticed it a couple of times in movies, but I'm trying to figure out exactly what it is. The first time I noticed it was in every terrible Kevin James movie ever made. But I noticed it most recently.
Which is all of them.
Yeah.
Which is every 100%. Kevin James movie ever made.
I think we're at a consensus on that.
And so, but here's the interesting thing. And I also noticed this most recently when I saw Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them. So, harkening back to these horrible Kevin James movies, in a lot of them, like, let's just say Hitch, but we could also say...
Which wasn't one, actually. There's the exception.
Yeah, there's the exception.
I just thought that, too.
But I was about to say Paul Blart Mall Cop, which, other end of the
which
spectrum.
Which is not an exception.
But so there's this central theme where there's, like, some really stunning, pretty, like, hot girl.
Oh, yeah.
Who has, like, a romance. And people love to watch that. Mm-hmm. And so I was really trying to psychoanalyze that when I was watching Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them, because there's something similar in that movie.
Yeah, there's kind of this nerdy nerdy guy.
Kind of like overweight, geeky, kind of socially inept, but for some reason, this really hot girl just fetishizes them and just, like, loves them. And so...
Not saying that that isn't...
Can't, not saying like, that that can't happen,
that's not okay.
But...
I mean, you don't have to be exactly compatible.
No, but I'm just wondering why that's kind of a common theme in movies.
It is
like
a theme, yes.
if there's a male actor who, like, let's just arbitrarily use Kevin James, who isn't maybe not the most objectively attractive, and like he's like,
I mean, he's no Ryan Gosling.
No, and he's yeah, he's heavier. Clearly. He's your like classic goofy guy. He's not even that good of an actor. But in almost every movie, he gets a really hot. He ends up with like a really hot romantic lead. But that's not something you see in. Like, if there's, like, a less attractive or heavier woman in a movie...
No, she always gets a makeover.
She either gets a makeover or she's the comedic relief.
Yeah.
But she's not going to end up with Ryan Gosling at the end. You don't see that ever. And yet, like, on this other side, when we have, like, men that are heavier or less attractive or even, like, really skinny, very, very scrawny, we like to watch them get... end up with this very attractive female lead. Mm. And so bringing this all back to body image, I feel like there are body issues, but the repercussions of them are a little bit different.
I see.
And definitely, like, pop out and correct me if I'm wrong, but that, you know, maybe with men's body issues, whether it be too overweight or too scrawny, that doesn't necessarily reflect back on their personalities like it does for women.
So you're saying if I am not the ideal physically, all is not lost.
Yes.
There are other...
You can still end up with the quote unquote like hot female lead if, you know, you have a great personality or it doesn't like ascribe to like who you are as a person, because you can still be the funny guy or and still have this whole like this holistic emotional romantic life, which I don't know if women get that as much in the media.
I've actually thought of that before. I remember as a teenager, I struggled with, you know, self-esteem. Like pretty much every teenager ever. And I remember thinking, well, I'm lucky that I'm a guy and that it's not the other way around, because I can find a girl who will like my personality and think I'm funny and appreciate and think I'm smart. And those are valuable. Whereas, you know, if it were the other way around, maybe it would be a little bit harder challenge to find a guy like that. Mm. I remember thinking that as a teenager.
Which is interesting that was so apparent to you so young. But did you ever feel like, especially going through like those very, very tender years?
The tender years.
The tender, such a
euphemism. So sweet.
Oh my gosh.
That, you know, like I need to look a certain way. Did you ever feel any body pressures yourself?
The only thing really for me was glasses. Mm-hmm. I got glasses in elementary school. I was pretty skinny. I was a skinny kid. I didn't really bother me. People called me chicken legs. I just thought it was them being dumb. I think it helped that I was really smart and I could run fast. And so if they wanted to trade insults, I usually would come out on top. Mm-hmm. And then if they tried to get physical, I could usually outrun them. And that happened a lot.
There's also that pressure too. And I don't know if this was just inherent or felt this, is to be athletic.
Yeah, absolutely. There are a couple of things I remember about that. One of them is in elementary school, we used to play handball. I really liked it. I thought I was good at it. And then over time, as I kind of paid attention, it seemed like there were people in my class, guys, who were really good at handball, and kids kind of gravitated towards them. They were kind of the more popular. And then there seemed to be this inverse relationship. The kids that tended to be not very good at handball, they were smart. They were the ones in class that answered all the questions correctly. And I remember wondering which one I was. And I remember wondering which one I wanted to be, because the kids that were good at handball, everyone seemed to like them and they seemed happy all the time. But then the kids that were smart in the class, you know, got good grades and the teacher seemed to think highly of. So I don't know if I actually consciously chose or if just kind of my genetics took over for me, but I ended up being one of the smart kids, not the athletic kids. And that came back again when I was in junior high and high school. We liked to play football at recess or at lunch, and we weren't allowed to play tackle football. So one person's responsibility who wasn't playing would be to watch out for the yard supervisor person who walks around.
Yeah, the recess lady.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And signal to us when that person was circling around back in view, and we would stop playing tackle and start playing two-hand touch. And I frequently volunteered to be that guy because I didn't want to play tackle, and I wasn't very good at it, but I didn't want to be labeled as, you know, a wuss or someone who wasn't any good. So I thought, well, I can help out the team and make it seem like I'm a good sport, but not have to go through that stuff.
And that's like, I think that's something, I don't know like the psychology term for it, but like that kids like developmentally until they reach a certain age, they only think in categories and they think very black and white, very binary. And I was actually talking about this week, and we're talking about like how like you can try so hard to like make kids not think that way, but like developmentally it's very challenging. So, like, what you were talking about, like, either you're smart or you're athletic. But until they reach a certain age, kids don't developmentally can't think, I am a complex human being with, like, diverse interests. So is everyone around me. And so they see each other as very flat characters, as very static. And so I think that's very interesting, just taking that framework. And like you were saying, it applies differently, I think, to boys and to girls. And I mean, maybe not that differently. Girls, you're the pretty cute ones, or like you're like the brainy girl.
Like Velma?
I was always Velma. I was never Daphne.
Alas.
Dang it. So, yeah, I think a lot of times with boys, it gets cut along like the athleticism or you're smart, and which I think is detrimental on both, like you were talking about. Like it's detrimental, like, oh, I can just be smart, I'm not athletic. But I think it's also detrimental of like, oh, well, I'm sporty. Like, I don't want to be, like, the smart kid. And I don't know if there's really, like, a way to work around it.
And I think one of the most damaging things with that is, along with those, like, activity categories, we assign, like, gender or sexuality categories. So, like, the guys who do the plays or are really artsy, we, like, they're the gays.
Yeah.
I mean, this is, you know, very...
is what they say. This is not what we say.
Yeah. Right. And then the guys who do football are, like, super manly, and they're really, they are strong and capable and, you know, everything that there is to be a man. And obviously, we know as adults that those are very polarized stereotypes and that they're not all-inclusive. And I think society reinforces that dichotomy, which is bad. I mean, even though children aren't culpable for all the societal damages that their dichotomies create, we definitely reinforce those. The typical teenage drama movie will show you that. High School Musical, for one. Like,
I don't want to be a jock. I want to be in a play.
Exactly. Like, that's so stupid.
Yeah. In reality, like...
such a crisis.
Yeah, and that's just such a fake binary. Like, just do both. Right. Like,
well, and I think that's a great point because in a more broad sense... that's really damaging across society in general, where the less we pay attention to nuance and to intricate coordination of different aspects of our lives or different principles that govern our lives.
Inclusivity.
Yeah, exactly. The more we respond to labels or categories and not, you know, a holistic view, the more exclusionary we are, and it reinforces these negative things that get more and more extreme. If you stay in a restricted category, then that category gets more extreme over time.
And it becomes your identity.
Yes.
Yeah. You identify yourself with that category.
Yes, which is so damaging that, like, because you think, like, that is all I am. I think it's so freeing when you're able to break out and be like, oh, wow, I can literally do whatever I want.
Yeah.
Okay, case in point, and this may be a little bit of a tangent, but it applies.
Okay.
So going back to, like, I was always, like, the brainy gal, like, in school. And I was always Velma. But sometimes, you know what? Sometimes, just sometimes, I want to be freaking Daphne, okay?
I mean, they both solve mysteries.
So, I'm going to get a little revelatory.
Okay.
Yeah, so I'm getting my master's degree. I consider myself a fairly intellectual person, like, operate, like, professionally and academically at a fairly high level. But I also take a dirty dancing class at Vasa Fitness.
All right.
Really?
They have that.
They
get
do.
It, girl.
They do. Which... is kind of like me finding my own way out of the binary, because it's me, and, like, that room is packed, but it is packed with every high school slutty girl in a 10-mile radius.
Wow.
Like, if I wear a tank top
not
and leggings...
Not to label people.
Not to label people, but that's probably how they label themselves. And...
oh my gosh.
Like I show up in, like, a tank top and leggings, and I'm like... But so I was standing there last night, and I was like, you know what? I love doing this. Like, A, it's so fun, but B, it's... I'm getting my master's degree.
Yeah.
And I can still go to a dirty dancing class, and I can still have... obviously, I have other interests besides that. And, like, I can read, and I can like a wide variety of different things, and all of them add up to a complex human being that is unique. Bringing this tangent back to the topic at hand, I think that that is so important for men and women. It's something that's harder for, I think, boys and girls to get at a younger age, but especially for men and women, and maybe more especially for men who are, I think, a lot more limited in what society, quote-unquote, allows them to do. I mean, yeah, we laughed at, like, the High School Musical example, but, like, that's actually true in that, oh, he's a jock, but, like, maybe people will think he's gay if he does.
Right, and it's not like that's some antiquated 1960s, 1950s view. No, that's very modern. And I think the theme of our
that our podcast has taken is that holistic view of ourselves, that we are mm-hmm. more than just
everyone
our labels.
Yeah, and everyone has a right to be a multifaceted, multidimensional, complex human being, because that's what we are. Just for laziness sake or just the way our brain works, we don't see each other that way. We see each other as very one-dimensional.
So I mentioned earlier that a lot of the social constructs are kind of left over from evolutionary process. So, and that is one of them, actually.
Yeah.
Our minds are only capable of identifying so much stimulus at once that we have kind of developed a screening tool. And so one of the ways that we screen for what's relevant, what's not relevant, is by labeling and categorizing and identifying mm-hmm. quickly. And so we can look at, you know, say, a rock rolling down a hill and decide if that's a danger to us. Or we can hear, I don't know, a saber-toothed tiger roar in the distance, and we can decide if that's a danger to us. So I think that that's one of those things that at some point served, you know, a life-saving purpose, but that we've grown to the point where it's there really isn't any benefit in the long term, and it has potential for damage more than good.
I mean, I think we all do it. We're all obviously proponents of a very holistic view, but like you said, like, our brain, that's very against, like, what our brain naturally does. Like, it's hard, like, especially, like, when you're in a new environment, you're in new student orientation, or you move into, like, a new apartment, and you're just surrounded by new people, and that's when I catch myself doing it. I can think of myself as very open-minded when I am in familiar situations,
mm-hmm.
like, with people I know, but, like, when you meet new people, I just catch myself doing that, like, ugh, she seems weird. Or just like, oh, we don't seem like, I don't think we'd really be friends. But that's, I mean, what is that based off of? Things that...
Yeah, very little information. And I think, especially in our political climate today,
mm-hmm.
that is pervasive, that we see, like, somebody makes some remark or some comment, and we immediately label them with horrendous things, like mm-hmm. racist or xenophobe or misogynist
mm-hmm.
or whatever. And we use that to define that person. And after that, every piece of information that comes at us from that person or from that source, we immediately discredit. And we do have to process a ton of information very quickly, and those snap judgments sometimes serve a purpose. But when we view people or individuals as monoliths based on what they say or do in a very isolated incident, then that can become dangerous. And the feminist movement has faced that by, like,
mm-hmm.
I mean, one topless protester, and all of a sudden we're all these...
bra-burning man.
Right,
yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Sexualizing, whatever.
Yeah.
That doesn't define everybody.
No. I think I've mentioned this before. My planner is bright pink, and it says feminist agenda. And I love that planner. Like, it's so great. But I was sitting next to, like, one of my really good guy friends in class this week, and I was, like, writing it in. He's like, I don't think you're a feminist. But he meant it in a nice way. No, you're not a feminist. And I was like, why would you, like, say that? I actually find that offensive that you would say that I'm not.
Yeah.
I actually don't think they're feminists and not feminists. I think they're just normal people and sexist.
Mm-hmm.
So why would you put me in the sexist camp? And he was just like, oh, and then he just, like, got weird about it. He was like, never mind. But it was weird that he thought it was a compliment. Oh, no, sweetie, like, you don't need to identify with that.
Oh, my gosh.
Wow.
It's because there are one or two people, and I think this also goes back to stereotypes, there are one or two people or one or two archetypes just kind of set the expectation for everyone in that, like, quote-unquote category, even if those categories are as broad as men and women.
I was reading a study recently that talked about how, generally speaking, the more informed a person is on a topic, the less extreme their stance on that topic is.
That makes sense.
And at first it was talking about political issues.
Mm-hmm.
So they interviewed a bunch of people about different political things and then rated somehow their familiarity with that topic, and so that's what they found, that they were less extreme the more they understood it. And I think that that is significant both for suggesting one of the problems that exists between, you know, men and women relationships, and also suggesting the solution. And that the more nuanced and the more balanced I allow myself to be and my identity overlaps into different categories, then the more I'm able to relate to you in the same kinds of overlap and the same kind of nuance.
That is a super great point. Mm-hmm. Like, that's really, like, acceptance of being holistic beings. That's how I feel like, we cross this binary for everyone, and we're able to relate to a wider variety of people.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Joe, for being here with us in this episode. It's been so great to have the male perspective.
Thank you.
To open our eyes.
Again,
honored.
He's a real man. Real man in the studio.
Mm-hmm.
Sharing his manly perspective.
Yes. Not that means anything. That can mean anything you want it to mean.
Right.
It's not any better or worse than a female
bird. Oh, my gosh. Well, we are actually making this, since we've enjoyed Joe's presence so much, we're making this a two-part series. So this concludes the end of part one, and our next episode will be part two.
Look forward to that. This is Femme Bolden.